Next case, which is case number 63441, the State of Nevada versus William Brian Newcomer. Mr. Nelson on behalf of the appellant, State of Nevada. Mr. Kennedy on behalf of the respondent. So, Mr. Nelson, you may proceed. And how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
4 minutes, please, Justice.
May it please the Court, Bruce Nelson, appearing on behalf of the Clark County District Attorney's Office, representing the state in this case. I'd like to start off by saying it is a real privilege to appear before this Court. But in order to exercise that privilege, I had to waive my constitutional Fourth Amendment rights twice in the last 24 hours. I had to waive them when I flew up here, and frankly, I had to waive them when I came into this room. Because I asked the marshal after I went through the metal detector, suppose somebody came up, demanded to be let in, and refused to go through the metal detector, and he said I would not let them in. In both of those cases, however, my waivers were required and valid because, one, there's a very strong public safety need to engage in those types of searches, and number two, I have a diminished expectation of privacy. I have to disagree with counsel in the last case on one point. Everybody who drives in Nevada does not consent to a test. Because the statute provides, in order to be compelled to consent, the police must have reasonable grounds to believe you are impaired. And this Court found in Davis, that means you're either dead or unconscious, or you're under arrest. So a person has to be arrested before they can be compelled to submit to a search. Well, in the Florence decision, the United States Supreme Court said when someone is arrested, they can be compelled to submit to a search that is far more invasive, far more invading of privacy. That is a body cavity search when they're taken down to the jail without a warrant, without even seeing a judge first. The court has also held in the context of an airport search that a person can be subjected to what amounts to a strip search. It may be a virtual strip search, but it is a strip search nonetheless. Because if you'll pardon my expression, when you go through that x-ray machine, you're checked inside and out. But the underwear bomber and the shoe bomber have made those types of searches valid. So with regard to the implied consent law, we have number one, the person has to be arrested, diminished expectation of privacy. Number two, the person is traveling. Now we have a DUI checkpoint law from the Supreme Court called Michigan v. Stitz, which says if you're driving along and you encounter a DUI checkpoint, assuming there's nowhere to turn off, you must go through the checkpoint. Put another way, you must give up your Fourth Amendment right as a condition of driving on the roadway insofar as the checkpoint is concerned. When you go into the checkpoint, you must interact briefly with the police. You can't drive in, leave your window up, and hold up a sign that says, go away, I don't want to talk to you. You have to wind your window down, the police will speak to you briefly, and then you'll either be on your way or subjected to further searches and so on and so forth. Finally, there's one other point I wanted to make. When someone is driving on the state highway, the state is the landlord of that highway. In Hud v. Brucker, the United States Supreme Court recognized that when the state is acting as a landlord, it can engage in activities far more than it can when it's not. That was an 8-0 decision by the Supreme Court interpreting a statute that says if you're in Section 8 housing, you can be thrown out of your house if there's any drug activity in your home, even if it's done without your knowledge or consent. But the Supreme Court said that because the state is acting as a landlord in that situation, it can basically have such a regulation. Now, all those things standing together do not mean that a warrantless blood draw is permissible in every case, but it does mean that the implied consent law is valid. Secondly, there's a strong public safety element. This court has long recognized.
Mr. Nelson.
Yes, Justice.
Implied consent in all cases, all circumstances, or limited?
Well, limited to highways, because the Supreme Court also recognized in the DUI checkpoint case that while you can have a DUI checkpoint, you can't have a drug interdiction checkpoint.
Have we had any DUI checkpoints since McNeely?
Yes, Metro had one, or police department.
No, the Supreme Court opined.
Oh, no, the Supreme Court has not addressed checkpoints.
And I guess that's part of the why you're here today, because we have this ambiguity, so to speak, that we now have McNeely, so now we have to go back and relook at our jurisprudence because of this, and based upon the recitation you cited as to the history that's gotten us at this point, now we have McNeely, and how do we reconcile?
Well, I reconcile that because McNeely has absolutely nothing to do with implied consent laws. McNeely's only discussion of an implied consent law is to call it a legal tool. Well, if it's unconstitutional, the Supreme Court would not refer to it as a legal tool. The Supreme Court cited with approval in McNeely South Dakota versus Neville, which is important for two reasons. Number one, Neville says that when someone refuses, their refusal is admissible against them in court. But if they have a constitutional right to refuse, that's impossible, because you cannot be penalized for exercising your constitutional right. You cannot lose your license, you cannot commit a separate crime, and you cannot have your admission used against you in court. Secondly, as the previous counsel noted, Neville repeatedly says that the state may force a person to submit to a test. Part of the language in South Dakota v. Neville: respondent's right to refuse the blood alcohol test, by contrast, is simply a matter of grace bestowed by the South Dakota legislature. Now, Neville was not overruled. In fact, it was cited with approval by the court in McNeely. Why would the court do that if it intended that there was now a constitutional right to refuse to take a test?
But if by the same token, when the court in McNeely describes or refers to implied consent laws, it's saying such laws impose significant consequences when a motorist withdraws consent, and then it goes on to list some of them. Loss of license, evidentiary use against you in a prosecution. But it seems to me the court is signaling, perhaps we're reading tea leaves here, that the implied consent laws that it's regarding as legitimate tools are those that afford the motorist the opportunity to withdraw the consent and therefore face consequences. The ones they're listing are different from saying, if you withdraw the consent, we're going to take it anyway. Well, I mean, that's the question there.
They do mention in McNeely that some states do allow you to basically withdraw your consent, or I shouldn't say that. They allow you to refuse. You can't withdraw your consent. You can refuse and suffer penalties. However, they go on to note that many states don't do that. The last listing I had from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration was 28 states allow some form of mandatory blood testing in a DUI case. The overwhelming majority, obviously, are in death or substantial cases.
So the question follows, are there courts out there that have held, separate and distinct from McNeely's exigency ruling, an implied consent statute is valid post-McNeely?
That
carries the price tag of, if you say no, it's a forced blood draw.
Well, I'm unaware, first of all, of any such published opinion at this point. However, it's kind of interesting. In a sense, Nevada's law towards a defendant is the most liberal in the entire country, because here's why. Someone gets stopped for drunk driving in California and they refuse. Their refusal is admissible against them. The police can use lawful means to obtain the blood and use the result against them, and they suffer some other penalty, which, by the way, again, if you have a constitutional right to refuse, you can't suffer any penalty for that.
Right.
If you get stopped in Nevada, one, when you refuse, your refusal is admissible against you. Two, the police can use lawful means to draw your blood. And three, well, there is no three. So from a defendant's perspective, I'm almost sorry to say, the best place to drive for the implied consent law is in the state of Nevada. The legislature decided to eliminate all other penalties and felt it was sufficient simply to draw the defendant's blood. Now, the defense made a number of arguments down below. The primary one that the lower court seemed to bite off on, if you'll pardon the expression, was that a person could withdraw their consent at any time, but they can't. The United States versus Akai, that was an airport case where the defendant went in, got searched. The TSA said, we found something, and the defendant says, stop, I withdraw my consent, I'm leaving. And the Ninth Circuit said, you can't do that. You can't let a terrorist go into the airport with a bomb when the TSA finds the bomb and say, stop, I'm taking my bomb and going home. And then mumbling to himself, I'll come back and try again later. Well, you can't allow somebody to drive drunk and repeatedly keep doing that simply by refusing to take a test. Now, the defense also argued, and the lower court seemed to buy into a little bit, that reasonable force is permissible. Well, reasonable force is permissible in any search. Somebody's arrested and taken down to the jail and told they have to undergo a body cavity search, and they say, no, I'm not. The police say, yes, you are. And they hold the person down and conduct the search. The amount of reasonable force is determined by the amount of resistance that is put up by the defendant. Finally, Justices, I think I should leave the last word on the issue of whether you can refuse to State versus Rowley, which is a 629 SE 2nd 188 Virginia decision, admittedly pre-McNeely, but I think it hits the nail on the head. Rowley, like all drivers, consented to submit breath samples by exercising the legal privilege of driving on the Commonwealth's roads. This consent is not qualified or conditional. To allow it to be unilaterally withdrawn would virtually nullify the implied consent law. And finally, the defendant says, well, I agreed in this case, but I was coerced because I was told if I didn't submit to a test, the police would use reasonable force to draw my blood. Well, that was addressed in a post-McNeely decision, State v. Moore, 318 P3rd, 1133, where the Oregon court said, how can it be coercive to tell somebody about the legal consequences of their actions? Here, all the police told the defendant was, if you refuse, the law allows me to use reasonable force. There's no question that was the law. There's no question, therefore, that the defendant was not coerced. So, the bottom line here is the implied consent law is a valid exercise of the police power. Nothing in McNeely changed that at all. McNeely specifically did not change that, and it specifically cited cases that recognize that the police can force someone to do a blood draw. The fact that Nevada has chosen to mandate a blood draw if a person refuses is of no constitutional import, because either it's legal or it's not. If you have a constitutional right to refuse, as I said, every implied consent law in the country is invalid. Every implied consent law that allows any type of mandatory search is invalid. Any implied consent law that imposes any penalty is invalid. That's simply not the law, and the Supreme Court did not find that to be the law in the McNeely decision.
Mr. Nelson, let me ask you one other question. It's my understanding Judge Bixler didn't do any analysis on the good faith exception. Is that correct?
That's correct, Justice. I was actually going to save that for rebuttal, but I'll be happy to go into it now. There's no question here the police were acting in good faith. They followed Supreme Court law, the Neville decision. They followed this court's law, Charles and Jones. They followed the law of the Ninth Circuit. They did exactly what the law allows them to do. Now, the defense in this case takes the only possible position that it can. It argues that, oh, no, no, Schmerber made it clear that you have to have a warrant to do a blood draw. Well, aside from the fact that the case law recognized otherwise, there are two problems with that opinion. The first problem is that we're here today. If Schmerber was clear that you had to get a warrant to do a blood draw, surely some defense attorney in the state of Nevada would have brought that to this court's attention in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. Yet we didn't hear any of this until after McNeely. Well, there are only two possible explanations. One is, for the past 50 years, every defense attorney in the state of Nevada has been incompetent. Or two, McNeely announced a new rule of law. The McNeely court granted cert to resolve a split of authority. But if the issue is well settled, that's impossible. There can't be a split of authority on a well-settled issue. And again, that raises only two possibilities. Half the judiciary in the United States, including every single one of your predecessors who recognized the validity of forcible blood draws and no with no refusals, didn't know what they were doing. Or two, McNeely announced a new rule of law. There was one post-McNeely decision I found, State v. Adkins, 81A3rd 680, a New Jersey decision.
Could you give us a cite again?
Certainly. It's 81A3rd 680, New Jersey, 2013. New Jersey's law does not recognize good faith in the Leon concept, that is, where the police make an honest mistake. However, the court found that because the implied consent law allowed the blood draw and because McNeely arguably changed that, the police were acting in absolute good faith. I think the best way to view good faith is it's a form of ex post facto protection for the police. Everybody agrees that if a defendant does something, the legislature can't subsequently make it illegal and then retroactively apply it to the defendant. Well, when the police follow the law, that's a good thing. That's what we want them to do. We don't then change the law, retroactively apply it to their conduct, and say, oh, no, no, now we're going to suppress the evidence. As the New Jersey court noted, the only thing you'd be suppressing in that case is good police work.
Mr. Wilson, is the law to protect the police or to protect the person that's being charged?
Well, the law should protect two people, the person being charged and the general public. And when I talk about protect the police, what I'm really saying is protect the public. The Supreme Court in great detail in Davis and Crowe went into the effect that the exclusionary rule has, and the exclusionary rule should be...
Well, I understand protecting the officers from doing their job in a civil context, but in a criminal context, when there's a sea of change, is it thereby still appropriate to go back and say, well, this was a law, we're going to enforce it no matter what? No one's talking about necessarily putting the officers at risk for their conduct in this particular setting and case. The question is, if an individual, as this debate is going back and forth, if the law has in fact been viewed that there was error, and in some cases even our Supreme Court says, well, we screwed it up the first time, but we're going to get it right this time.
But do we want to punish society by releasing otherwise guilty criminals by changing the law and retroactively applying it to the police?
And conduct? Do we wish to punish society by keeping people in who have not committed a crime under the now existing laws purely to make a point?
Well, isn't that the entire ex post facto argument? That we don't punish people for something they did before when we change the law? I'd submit, Judge, I realize ex post facto only applies to the defendant, but nonetheless, good faith is an example of ex post facto applied to the state, that is, the people of the state of Nevada.
So, Mr. Nelson, we had some questions for you, so we did eat into your time a little bit, so we'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal. And Tracy, would you add 2 minutes to Mr. Kennedy's time as well?
Thank you, Justice.
Morning. May it please the Court. It's kind of unusual to be on the appellee side for a change. I'm normally on the other table there. I wanted to address what Judge Bixler did not address in that opinion, because it is a glaring point from that decision. He chose not to address the good faith exception, and that's really, I think, probably one of the core issues on McNeely and how to apply it. And although counsel's indicated that my only argument is Schmerber, I'll be so bold to talk about Schmerber. The McNeely decision, all that really did was clarify existing law that's been in place for the last 48 years in this country since the Schmerber decision regarding blood draws. It says the U.S. Supreme Court in McNeely did not announce a new rule of law. They just clarified what's always been the case ever since Schmerber. And if you really read the decision, it talks about the officer in that case found special facts, exigent circumstances that justified in that particular moment in time the warrantless blood draw from the suspect in that case. In Schmerber, there was an auto accident. The officer was busy investigating the accident, had to take the suspect to the hospital. Time was going by, and there was concerns about dissipation of alcohol. But the U.S. Supreme Court indicated that it was those special facts that justified him not taking the time back in 1966 to radio in or pick up the phone and call a magistrate judge sometime during the day to get a warrant. It was because of those exigent circumstances. And that's always the case. In every type of warrant case, you have exigent circumstances which justify a warrantless intrusion, which justify essentially ignoring the Fourth Amendment so that you can get the evidence you need because of certain facts. They're very special. That still exists. It exists in this case. It exists here in Nevada. You can avoid getting a warrant if you can show exigent circumstances.
So, Mr. Kennedy,
Justice Sato, why don't you go and then we'll have Justice
Mr. Baker. Kennedy, are you suggesting that McNeely is, as I believe you said, merely a clarification? It doesn't announce new law. It simply clarifies the Schmerber standard and simply addresses exigency and how it can be considered, period?
I think that's the nut of the case. Clearly, at least from our perspective, that's exactly what the U.S. Supreme Court was doing in McNeely, was just saying Schmerber has been in existence all this time. We're clarifying that. We're not overruling it. We're not expanding it. We're saying this has been the status of the law. And that comes into play when
so
you talk about
why did they accept cert on it?
If that was,
why did they accept cert on it? Just simply to address or define, better define exigency?
Well, boy, I don't know if I'd be so bold as to get into the minds of the U.S.
Supreme Court. And as soon as I asked the question, I realized that's probably a question that you can't answer. But I guess my point is still the same. If it was as simple as defining exigency, why can't we leave that to each of the states who have their own laws and considerations?
Because we're dealing with a concept that at its core is a Fourth Amendment issue, and that has nationwide implications. And that's what makes it that so important and requires perhaps a federal intervention through the U.S. Supreme Court to apply this, to make sure it's applied uniformly across the country. Going back to good faith, the good faith exception, as I understand it, is if the officer relies on binding judicial precedent to make his warrantless arrest, then it's excused. It's not excludable. The binding judicial precedent has been in place since 1966 for 48 years. I know counsel said that means every defense attorney has been incompetent and nobody knows what they're doing. I'm not going to speak to that, but I mean, this court in 1989, I cited in my brief, did look at Schmerber. And I'd have to admit that in 1989, I think the Nevada Supreme Court misinterpreted Schmerber, because in that Smith v. State decision, which is in my brief, The court stated that Schmerger stands for the idea that you can get a warrantless blood draw because of the natural dissipation of alcohol. That's not what Schmerger stands for.
McNeely is your main argument here, and Justice Sotomayor says that we granted cert to resolve a split in authority on whether dissipation of alcohol is a per se exigency or something that requires more analysis. I mean, she said there's a split in authority, and she seems to be right. My question was going to be, could you comment on, is she just simply wrong? There was no split of authority. It was, I don't know.
I'm not sure if I can speak to that again. I mean, clearly throughout the country there have been different cases, as you heard today from both sides. It's almost as though Schmerger was decided and then conveniently forgotten over the last 50 years and not applied. And as I was saying, this court in 89 applied Schmerger, I think, incorrectly because it found a holding that it basically was saying that if you have a DUI case and you're going to do a blood draw, you don't need a warrant because of the natural dissipation of alcohol.
Could you comment on the Kroll case? And there's evidently a split in courts elsewhere across the United States on whether good faith exception should even apply in this arena.
As I understood Kroll dealt with an Illinois statute governing administrative searches. Okay. Administrative searches dealing with car parts and car titles, things dealing with motor vehicles. It had nothing to do with the criminal prosecution. There's a distinction there, and that's the defining distinction between Kroll. Is that Kroll does give the pass and say that, an officer can objectively rely on, reliance on the statute authorizing warrantless administrative searches. The key is they're administrative searches. I think there's a different standard when you're looking at a civil administrative penalty versus liberty interests that are involved in a criminal case, and I think that's the distinction in Kroll and why I think it actually does not apply in this situation.
Mr. Kennedy,
yes, ma'am.
Would it then be an appropriate resolution of this case? It appears, and Judge Bixler wrote a fairly lengthy order in this case, but it appears as if he simply generically or broadly applied a McNeely analysis. Would it be harmful at all to your client if, in fact, we just simply remanded this for him to make a good faith determination?
Would it be harmful to my client? Well, right now my client sits in the catbird seat. He has a motion to suppress has been granted, but
certainly wouldn't. Let me clarify. Legally, that would be a sound decision for this court to make.
Conceivably, because that is missing from the order, and clearly, good faith is an important issue, and perhaps that may be an easy remedy of this case is to send it back for factual determinations on good faith. It is left out of the order in that lengthy 10, 11, 12-page decision, and it's noted certainly by the state in their opposition. And here I am talking about it because it wasn't addressed, and that may be the easy out perhaps for this case. More importantly, I think looking at the broader implications of how do we address, does this court address 44C-160? Does it go take this case and the other before us today and make the leap to address, is the implied consent statute constitutional? I would submit that based on McNeely and Schmerber and the case law that this court has heard, that Nevada's implied consent is unconstitutional. The mere fact that you get in your car, start that engine, and drive down Highway 380 from Reno to Carson City doesn't mean the moment I sit in that car that I'm giving up my constitutional rights. The submission to a lawful authority does not equate to consent. In other words, the mere fact that I'm complying with Nevada law, I get a license, I register my car, I turn that key on, and I go out on the highways, that doesn't mean that I've taken this great leap to consciously, knowingly, specifically, voluntarily waive important constitutional rights. You're not doing that when you get in, turn that key on, and drive that car. I certainly disagree with the state's position on that. Implied consent, the way it's written right now, I used some colorful language in my brief, and you'll forgive me, I was taking some liberties with that. But by forcefully taking the blood of a citizen, that is the most direct and form of intrusion anyone can have. You're pulling a bodily fluid from someone by the government. Taking their license, as the law was here in Nevada before 1995, is far less intrusive. And coming in here today, I was thinking, well, would the court even ask, so what should the court do? And what I would say is that 484C-167 should be declared unconstitutional. Obviously, the legislature will have to go back and look at it, but if the legislature were to go back and reinstate the statute as it was pre-1995, taking someone's license is far less intrusive when you under a Fourth Amendment analysis than grabbing a needle and pulling some blood and then maybe doing it again until you can find a vein. And believe me, I've had those cases where nurses at CCDC can't even find a vein, and the guy's arm is all peppered from trying to pull blood from this
person. Mr. Kenney, I understand your argument. I know some of us have tried a lot of these cases as trial judges, but what do you, when you have serious deaths and injuries and all like that, if there's no injury here, I understand your point on the, but you have criminal ramifications there from serious injuries. How else can the state gather the information to determine if somebody's driving above the legal limit or has drugs in their system and all, other than through the blood draws?
Well, the blood draw, and I'm jumping ahead there. The blood draw can happen, get the warrant.
Right.
If you got the warrant, then we're not making this argument, because a neutral, detached justice of the peace in Las Vegas has been contacted by the Metro or NHP, and they've issued a warrant, and that warrant provides justification based on probable cause to them draw that blood. And that can happen in the death or serious bodily injury case, and one could say it could even happen on the misdemeanor first offense case, as long as that magistrate's been called and woken up at 3 in the morning to authorize a warrant. And to allow this to happen. And in fact, as counsel indicated before, that practice has already been put into effect. I don't know up here in Reno, but in Carson City, but in Clark County, they're trying to do that, and they're actually trying to secure warrants, or at least advising defendants. Then they read the admonishment of rights form. At the end, they've added a sentence now that essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, if you refuse to accept, consent to a test, we can apply for a warrant and get permission from the court to take your blood. So to answer your question, long-winded way, bloods can still be taken as long as you have the warrant to do it, and that provides the cover, as it were, for the Fourth Amendment intrusion in pulling someone's bodily fluid. I also wanted to address the issue of consent. In this case, Mr. Newcomer did indeed consent to the blood test, and this ties in certainly with counsel's argument about being on the roads and implied consent. It's my position and the position of the appellee that consent is not voluntary when you're facing repercussions, serious repercussions, if you don't. In this case, being held down, being forced to give blood. Consent is only viable and valid when it's freely given. It's a choice being made. Now, this is not to say that a suspect sits there at the county jail and, he said, well, here's your choice, and everybody sits around for 30 minutes waiting for him to think whether he wants to do it or not. But if the choice is, yet you either give your consent or we're going to pull this blood out of you, whether you like it or not, and hold you down, that's not a valid free consent. And I think the consensus of U.S. Supreme Court case law is that to give consent, it needs to be done so in a free and voluntary manner, with an understanding of what you're doing. And that's
you would
not
accept the argument that consent is the moment you choose to drive your car. You are consenting to application of this implied consent law in the event you drive drunk.
No way.
Okay.
No way.
And do you get that out of McNally, or do you get it out of somewhere else?
It's a cross-section of cases I've looked at. I mean, I quoted Florida versus Roger, 460 U.S. 491 at page 497. U.S. Supreme Court said, mere submission to a lawful authority does not equate to consent. Rather, valid consent must be unequivocal and specific and freely and intelligently given. We're talking about a Fourth Amendment right. We're not talking about some sort of a Clark County Code or something like that. We're talking about one of the rights that we in this country hold dear and that are important to our existence, the Fourth Amendment, Fifth, the Sixth, all those rights that seem to be forgotten sometimes.
What about the underwear bomber at the airport? I mean, he doesn't get the chance to back out of the process. He has to go.
And that's a fair point. I came up here this morning, and I was subjected to that in Las Vegas, going through the machine. The difference is, I think, is the level of intrusion. I'm not. They're not pulling my DNA. They're not running my DNA to see if I'm a terrorist by my DNA makeup or anything like that, or running a blood test on me. They're basically taking a snapshot of me in a less intrusive manner. And I think it's fact specific. I mean, here we are. You know, we're splitting the hairs here. But going through the airport scanner, where they take your picture or they just pat you down, is less intrusive. And coming through here, where I was not pat down, I did go through the machine and I gave them my phone, and I came through. I wasn't asked by the marshal out there to subject any intrusive test. There are degrees of the level of intrusiveness. And going through the airport is far less intrusive than being held down by an NHP officer, tied down to a chair, and have a phlebotomist come up to you at CCDC and pull blood from you while you're tied down. That's a very intrusive setting. And I think that's the distinction I would draw between counsel's argument regarding the airport and this situation.
I think, though, the airport would ripen into something intrusive if they found something suspicious.
Sure. And then you have concerns about the overriding safety of hundreds or if not thousands of people in the airport building and the 200 or 300 people on the airplane. So I guess there are degrees there of application of the Fourth Amendment in that situation for the greater good.
Okay. Right.
And one could say, well, is that not the greater good to remove drunk drivers from the road? Sure. It's important to get drunks off the road. They shouldn't be on the road. But there's a procedure to follow. And if you want to take a blood draw, great. Get that warrant. And now with their electronic means to quickly get, and I think Metro has even done that in Las Vegas. So there's a process they've started to make the warrant application something more fast-tracked than waiting, you know, running off to judge's chambers and have a warrant. They're not doing that. They're contacting them by email or quick phone call or something like that to arrange it. So it can be done in a timely, efficient manner so the police don't lose time during the arrest.
Are there any post-McNeely decisions, I've asked this question of everyone, that say the implied consent is distinct from exigency holding in McNeely, and we're going to either validate or invalidate an implied consent law such as Nevada's that carries the price tag of forced blood draw if you refuse?
I have not seen that yet. And
so we're right on the edge of that here.
This court has the great luck of being that court to possibly make that decision. So
thank you.
Mr. Kennedy,
yes, sir.
In the space that we're in, there's a 2007 decision by the Ninth Circuit where they looked at checkpoints and securing buildings and other things, and they made this statement, special government needs beyond the normal need for law enforcement. How do we balance this? This is back to what you and Mr. Nelson talked about, the search coming in here, the airport, in a DUI situation. What is the difference special government needs beyond the normal need for law enforcement?
I think perhaps, I haven't read that case, but I would say a special government need in case of searches at a government building. We all know what happened in Oklahoma City and, of course, 9/11, things of that type. Those are special government needs to secure public buildings from potential terrorist activity. I think there's a heightened state of awareness that certainly expands the reach and stretch of what we consider Fourth Amendment analysis. Perhaps that may justify that. Once again, we come back to that greater good issue. But there is a distinction between, say, a checkpoint, sobriety checkpoint, versus pulling blood from the body. I think it's, again, degree and level of intrusiveness is the distinction I'm trying to make on that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kennedy. Mr. Nelson, you have 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Justices. If I gave everyone in this room a choice of three searches, I would submit that everybody would submit to search A. Search A is a blood test. Search B is a strip search. Search C is a body cavity search. Yet B and C are legal in certain circumstances without a warrant, for example, when a person's arrested. The defense talked about we need to protect us from Oklahoma City and 9/11 and so on, and that's certainly true. That's why we have those searches allowed at the airport. How many people died in plane crashes last year? How many people were killed by drunk drivers last year? The interesting distinction about what I think are the three important cases in this case, Schmerber, McNeely, and Neville, is this. Schmerber and McNeely did not deal with an implied consent law. Neville did. Neville upheld the implied consent law and noted that you can force a person to submit to a test. The defense mentioned the Smith case, which was in 1989. This court decided in 1995 in Jones distinguished the implied consent from a search where a person is not driving. Thus, a driver suspected of intoxication may be forced to give a blood sample. So this court has already recognized that you can compel a person once they are A, driving, But it goes further than that. B, impaired. C, stopped by the police. And D, most importantly, the police have reasonable grounds to believe that they are impaired. In other words, the police can't pull Bruce Nelson over for speeding and say, I demand you take a blood test. But if Bruce exhibits all the symptoms of intoxication and fails his field sobriety test, then the court can. The implied consent law is especially important in the state of Nevada because we have what's called the two-hour rule. And we know from the Armstrong decision that if a blood draw is done beyond 2 hours, it is quite difficult to get a conviction. In fact, ironically, if the blood draw is beyond 2 hours, Armstrong said essentially that there needs to be multiple blood draws. That's going to require even more warrants and even more court action. Our Metro Police Department noted that 80% of our warrant requests right now are beyond 2 hours. They simply cannot get a magistrate, get the warrant done, get it back to the officer, and have the defendant's blood drawn within 2 hours. My final point, the statute, or I should say the federal regulation that recognizes you can search...
What happened to telephone warrants? They don't do telephone warrants?
They do telephone warrants, but even with a telephone warrant, it takes more than 2 hours.
They always got a hold of me. Didn't matter what time it was.
Well, it's not, the problem is not the judge. The problem is this, Justice. First of all, you have to stop the person. Then you have to determine that they're impaired. Then you have to give them field sobriety test. If there's a traffic collision, you have to take them down to the hospital. Then the officer needs to get a hold of the judge. Then they need to go through the process of the telephonic warrant. That is simply not happening in 2 hours. So our two-hour rule, I suppose, in one sense, creates an exigency all its own, but we don't need that because we have the implied consent.
Mr. Nelson, I'm going to have to wrap it up here in the fairness of dividing time equally between the parties. So thank you very much for your arguments, both of you. I may not have mentioned at the beginning of your argument, Justice Perigary isn't here today, but he will be listening to the oral argument and will be participating in the decision.
Thank you, Justices.
Okay. Thank you. This case will stand submitted and will be in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.